This is Don Hassig with Cancer Action Network. You are listening to Loving the Earth, a pollution-free revolution. Joining us today is Harvey Scott. Harvey is a resident of the province of Alberta. He is the founder of Keepers of the Athabasca Water Council. Good morning, Harvey.
Good morning, Donald.
Thanks much for being with us. I'm just so excited about this interview.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I should say at the outset, I'm one of the founders. A handful of people got together in 2007. Most of us have been environmental activists and warriors much of our adult lives. But most of us live in the Athabasca River Basin in Western Canada, and you know, we were inspired by the Irish doctor O'Connor, John O'Connor, who began to talk about the huge cancer rates and the very unique cancers downriver from our sort of tar sands development at Fort McMurray, Alberta, on the lower Athabasca, where it meets the Lake Athabasca and the Peace and the Slave Rivers. And so, yeah, I had organized a conference, and out of that conference, we built an alliance of Aboriginal people, what we call First Nations and Métis here, and the rest of us settlers who live in the valley, and plus the larger environmental groups and all the environmental groups throughout through not only Alberta but Canada and throughout the world. So we're quite an interesting alliance. We're based in the Aboriginal, if you will, Turtle Island spiritual belief that all of nature's elements are sacred, literally, water in particular, and air and land. And so our program is based in that. And yes, I'm one of the founders of that. We're part of we're the Athabasca Basin Council of the larger Keepers of the Water movement, which is again based out of the Northern Canada. The Dene or Athabascan speaking people started this back in 2006, and we are the Athabasca Basin Council of that. I should say that while we have the greatest admiration for Mr. Kennedy's Waterkeepers organization, which has basin keeper groups around the world, we're not part of that. We certainly work parallel with that, and we support it, but ours is fundamentally and profoundly rooted in our indigenous people's view of nature, which of course they developed over the thousands of years as hunter-gatherers living here sustainably. So there, it's the elders of the Aboriginal peoples, our Aboriginal peoples here, the Chipewyan, the Cree people, and all the others that have lived here for a long time, happily and sustainably. They're the people have inspired our keepers, the Athabasca, and all the branches, all of the tributaries of the huge Arctic Mackenzie River Basin, and we happen to be the group in the Athabasca Basin. And yes, I'm one of the founders, but I should say I'm a founding co-chair with Peter Ciprian, who's a Chipewyan Aboriginal person from Fort Chipewyan, and Cleo Reese, who's a Cree person from the Fort McMurray First Nation, and we have a Métis co-chair from the Métis Nation of Alberta as well. So, yes, it's been wonderful for me to be involved in that. I'm kind of an old environmental organizer for the decades. I previously taught at the University of Alberta. I taught outdoor environmental education. So when I took early retirement, this has been a kind of a wonderful opportunity for me.
Well, give us a few of the, say, the highlights, you know, and that's not the perfect word, but say looking back through the past couple decades, looking back to, you say, the time that you were teaching the University of Alberta, meeting people, getting further along on this path of being a leader in bringing change that protects the earth, and then meeting these Native Americans, these First Nations people, and coming to the, you know, the Athabasca River Valley. And just give us some of the points that you know, just bring to your mind, which were, you know, this important parts of you being where you are today.
Right. Well, thanks, Don. I would, in fact, I would go back to my own beginnings in Ontario, Canada, on the the northern shores of Lake Ontario in the Bay of Quinte. Our people, both my wife and I, our people are settlers there. We fled your New York State and New England after the American Revolution. We chose the loyalist side, and so with our Mohawk allies, we came to that part of the Lake Ontario and the Bay of Quinte, and of course it was teeming with wonderful salmon and all kinds of wildlife. That was sort of Iroquois hunting territory, and anyway, we came with them. That's in the 1780s, and it was wonderful and bounteous, but here it is, when I was a kid in the 1940s and 50s, and we're oblivious, of course, to what we're doing to those wonderful rivers. But the river I grew up on, the Trent, which empties into the Bay of Quinte, you know, there are a number of craft pulp mills on it. There's creosote plants and all manner of industry. And at that point, of course, we were quite oblivious to things like PCBs and so on. But, I would go fishing down the river on not every day, but some days I would go down and it seemed like most of the fish in the river were belly up. And again, we'd had a release from the pulp mill, and the oxygen levels and other contaminants in the river were such that. So that began to trouble me. I suppose that was sort of the beginning of an environmentalist. But when I left there and was teaching at the University of Alberta, and we became more and more environmentally aware there, and our own Environment Canada, the ministry in charge of environmental protection, began to look at problems around our country. And of course, the Bay of Quinte was found to be one of the world's hugest accumulation of PCBs, that over the decades that these pulp mills and creosote plants had run, it was all accumulating in the bay at the mouth of the Trent River. And at that time, and this is 30 years ago, I think it was estimated it would take $36 billion just to dredge the stuff, and then they didn't know what to do with it. And so they just let the sediment accumulate over. I guess that's the kind of experience that's really driven me as a citizen to get engaged heavily. And I guess that when living in the Athabasca Basin here, retired from teaching and acting kind of as a organic farmer and so on, we began to realize that if we weren't vigilant, the same thing would happen in all these wonderful wild rivers in Western Canada as well. And so I guess when I've been thinking about, I've been involved in organizing environmental groups and campaigns much of my adult life, but having heard what was happening downriver at Fort McMurray with the tar sands, and particularly having heard Dr. John O'Connor with his plaintive cry about these unusually high levels of cancers, and particularly unique cancers such as bile duct cancers and so on in Fort Chip, which is where all of the water and all of the residues that come down the Athabasca, they accumulate there at the foot of the river right there at Fort Chip. Fort Chip is essentially the sump, the sewage sump for the whole river. And John, when he raised the alarm, I said, we've got to do something about this. So I organized this conference here, and it was quite a good conference. We had Dr. O'Connor, Dr. David Schindler, who's one of the world's experts on water science and pollution. He was a key figure in getting the world to address the issue of acid rain with his work in northwestern Ontario. He's an American expat from Dakotas and one of our proudest environmental scientists here. Anyway, David and others began to point to concerns in the Athabasca Basin accumulating, and the government, of course, both our levels of government, our provincial government here in Alberta and the federal government, in a very cavalier fashion, had decided that they were going to go full speed ahead on tar sands development, despite the fact that the cumulative effects were largely unknown. They completely ignored the precautionary principle. So rather than kind of go slow, they just decided to go full speed ahead, and particularly with the waning resources of conventional oil and gas, I think they saw this as their opportunity to get rich and be greedy, and that's what's driven this whole huge development here.
Yeah, we're very, we see this as a very, very, very important part of our hemisphere for the next very many years, for certainly longer than you and I will be alive.
Right.
And I think this is going to end up being probably one of the most important environmental issues that people have dealt with, because it's right, this perfectly powerful time of when, like you say, people have been developing their environmental, their environmental views, their environmental stance, their environmental soul and, mind and heart. And at the same time, there's this other kind of process, this other, activity that's been going on in our society where that we've exhausted some of these sources of fuel, such as much of the sweet crude in the Middle East and some
right.
other sources of sweet crude. So now we're just having to make this choice between easy, kind of truly wasteful, easy access and truly wasteful uses of energy, as we've done in the past, or our environmental ethic, or our, what we believe in and what we stand for. So there are truly some really powerful parts of being human that are coming into, conflict, and decisions are having to be made which bring up these questions and these discussions and these arguments, really, about what is the right way to go. And you said the word greed. That is so much of our, our distant past, our near past, our current present, the
right.
what may, hopefully won't, but could well continue in the next, years and future. I think that this is a perfect opportunity for people to figure out how to somehow get people to change from greed, and then the ones that will not change from greed, how to keep them from ruining our world by basically just stopping them so they cannot just do their greed thing at our harm, at the
right.
damage to the whole world. So everything you're talking to us about right now, I consider to be the most top flight, most superlatively important of anything that people could be talking about in the U.S. and Canada. And I'm sure they're talking about it in other parts of the world, too, when one considers just how horrendous the greenhouse warming, the global climate change
right.
emissions are of tar sands activity. Let me think now. Tell us a little bit more about Dr. John O'Connor. He certainly is a major player here. Just, what was it like getting to know him and starting off on this path?
Yeah, well, John is, physically not a huge person. He's, he came over from Ireland to do a medical degree at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and then practiced there and began to practice out here at McMurray. And he contends he's anything but an environmentalist. He's basically a healer, a health professional, and that's his real interest. So this is not the first kind of campaign. He organized, for example, within the last 20 years, a campaign. He was concerned with the highway traffic deaths on this highway, this terrible highway that comes from Fort McMurray down towards Edmonton. And so he's been a battler. He's a warrior. But he was the medical officer of health in Fort Chipewyan, which is this downriver place that I talked about. It's Alberta's oldest settlement. And these people are at the bottom end of the sewer. And so John began to realize that there's something wrong here about the levels of illness, particularly cancers, but other things as well. And so John, he's the kind of person that speaks up. He's, as they say, he's not a huge man, and he still retains his very strong accent and language of his native Ireland from Limerick. But he's because of his position and his training and his you know, commitment is very, very powerful, sort of in a quiet way, and he gets your attention. And he got on our national network, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and started to speak. And now, you know, they've made documentaries. In fact, they made one kind of docudrama about him. And John carries on. As you may know, when he raised this concern, and the federal health officials, who are supposed to be concerned about the health of our Indigenous people, didn't really respond very actively, then he began to go to the media and became a real thorn in the side of not only the federal health officials but the provincial health officials, and eventually you know, they took action, and they basically said that he couldn't practice there, and so they sort of suspended his license to practice, saying that he was causing undue concern. And they claimed there were no demonstrated connection between the tar sands production and effluent and the health of people there. And of course, it's their responsibility to do something about it. But rather than support John, they tried to silence him, and so they denigrated him. And in fact, his provincial medical association, the government put the arm on them. So John was put down and denigrated, as was Dr. Kevin Timoney, who I think you've met, and Dr. Schindler. As soon as you speak out against the giant oil industry mega machine, you know, you're in trouble. And so John was the first one to get under the foot of government and industry, and so it took him a while to demonstrate that he was sincere, and he got his license back, and then he would speak. He never stopped speaking. The thing about John, he's got all kinds of courage. He's a classic kind of Irish warrior, and so he got suspended again, and eventually you know, he left Alberta and went to Nova Scotia to practice, but he continued to work with his patients through video in Fort Chip, and eventually he was cleared again, and he's back here now. And not only is he working in Fort Chip, but he's now the medical officer in Fort MacKay. And Fort MacKay is the Native community right in the middle of the tar sands development. That's where they lived, and that community. I used to work with a chief there, Dorothy McDonald. She died of lupus. I mean, there's, in addition to cancers, there's all kinds of horrific ailments that surface when you have, you're in such a toxic stew as it is there, both air and water. And so, Dorothy died of lupus, and then gradually the administration, the band councils, they decided that they couldn't fight it, so they're going to join it. So currently that community has opted for a compensation package. And now John is in there, and he's working with the band council, and he's gradually, I think, getting them to rethink about going along with this. Not that they went along with it, but so John is, you know, he's back there, and he's in his kind of quiet way in the community. He always gets the respect of his patients, the old Native elders in there, that some of them are part of our group, and they just love him because he's a good doctor, he's concerned about their health, but he's not afraid to speak out. I think that the big thing here in Alberta, and I assume it's the same in other oil states like Texas and Louisiana and so on, because so many people's livelihoods depend on the income from oil and gas, directly and indirectly. Everybody has a son or a cousin or a sister or somebody who gets a good living from oil and gas. And so it's very difficult to speak out. And I guess what John does, he speaks out. And what the keepers of the water and the keepers of the Athabasca have done along this basin is, and we're a very, you know, small, feeble kind of group of volunteers, but what we've done, we go into community, we have a forum, and we encourage people to speak their minds about their river. And it is their river. This is their homeland for thousands of years.
Exactly.
And and this is what happens. So John has given voice to it, and now other people speak out. And I guess the keepers provide a, an ongoing voice, an opportunity for people to speak out. And then we speak out in the press. And we're not reluctant to tell the Premier and the Prime Minister, you know, what we think of their ineffective, by design, deregulated, privatized, self-monitoring system, which is primarily designed to protect the bottom line of the corporations and the royalties of the government.
Yes, this is all about what we have observed here in the U.S. for so long. And see, it doesn't look quite as bad from the outside, and probably for those that don't do a lot of reading between the lines and that are not very adept at just clearly discriminating from about what's going on. But here in the U.S., our whole society places commerce as the top priority to such an extent that health, people, the matter of whether a person is going to get cancer or not get cancer is given a lower priority than commerce. And so what you're talking about, this is the very same thing with this money, these jobs, this apparently easy money. You know, and certainly there is an element of this situation which would cause, you know, everyone to conclude that it's, well, not correctly conclude because they're not looking at the big picture, but that in the short term, in the moment that we're all scrambling to survive in and, you know, just living our lives in, it might appear that this is a great bonanza, this great source of wealth and power, but it's only so short term, and it's only in that game of having the top priority be the commerce. And people, if they step back and they think about how valuable that river is and has been and will be and must, you know, just unless it's healthy, the people aren't going to be healthy. And it's the same way here. We are in New York State. I was born out in Wisconsin, but I grew up in the St. Lawrence River Valley on the New York State part of the St. Lawrence River Valley. There's a nice stretch of river from basically Clayton area down pretty much across the river from Kingston, Ontario, all the way up to Cornwall on your side, and Akwesasne on our side. That's all New York State, St. Lawrence River Valley, and I've been a part of that region for my whole life, really. I don't know if I'm ever going to get away from there. You know, I've had people say, you're never going to leave here.
It's a lovely place. Why leave? It's lovely.
Well, no, I tell you, here's why I think that it's not wise for me to spend my whole life here. It's because it's an eye of a storm, and that storm is the harm to human health that has been created by being downwind from the Ohio River Valley. So much of the province of Ontario, the developed part, the part that's got the air pollution sources, we have really high cancer rates here. And it's not just that we're downwind. I was speaking with Dr. Janet Sherman. She wrote Chemical Exposure and Disease, and she also wrote Life's Delicate Balance.
Okay.
Dr. Sherman just gave us this really powerful window that, see, I knew it, but I just hadn't thought about it as powerfully as she had thought about it. She was saying that we in the St. Lawrence River Valley were downstream from such a huge downstream. You know, we're downstream from all the rivers that run to the Great Lakes, all the Great Lakes. Then our St. Lawrence River is the sewer going out to the Atlantic Ocean all of that. And while we think about, there's this thing called the Lake St. Lawrence. It's a big impounded area of water that's above this power dam. They call it the Robert Moses or Franklin D. Roosevelt. I know they changed the names a couple times, I think. But anyway, this huge power dam on the St. Lawrence River at Messina.
Yep.
And then that whole lake of St. Lawrence is basically just a catchment basin for so much of what has been coming down that river all the time.
Wow.
That through that period of years, and this dam was built a long time ago, built back in the 1950s, I believe. So it certainly was in place there to trap a lot of contaminated sediment. And then there's this matter of offgassing. There's no – people think, you know, they think, oh, those PCBs are down the sediment at the bottom of the river, big deal. Well, see, they don't stay there. I know a researcher at the State University of New York at Oswego, this Ron Scudato, that did some studies where he was measuring the amount of PCBs that were coming out of the sediments, coming up into the water, and then volatilizing out of the river and into the air. This must be, and see, nobody's, you know, carefully examined this matter, but when you put it all together, we certainly here in the St. Lawrence River Valley have a good explanation, a good reasonable explanation of why we have such high cancer rates here.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'm not gonna, I'm just to be reasonable about my health. You know, I don't want to get cancer. Nobody does. I believe it would be wise for me not to live here all the time, all of my life.
That's tragic, eh?
You
can't stay in your homeland.
It's all, yeah, that's a problem. But see, the truth of it is, your homeland,
yeah,
where you are now, with that,
yeah,
river being so close, much, when I get on the St. Lawrence River in a canoe, I just kind of feel like, you know, what was it, what did it used to be like? What did,
yeah.
I'm always thinking, what did it used to be like? Not what it's like right now. I'm not enjoying what it's like right now.
Yeah.
I want to be part of my time. Part of my time in a place where I'm not looking back to the past for the, you know, the goodness and the pleasure and the happiness and the love of the river. I want to live it right here, right now, you know, where when I'm a part of it.
Well, where can you go, Donald? Where can you go?
Well, I know where I'll go. My brother is up on the Kuskokwim River up in Alaska, way
yeah,
up on the Kuskokwim,
yeah,
and he
yeah,
believes that's the place to be, but it's too cold for me. I truly love Saskatchewan. I love Saskatchewan.
Yeah, it's for canoeing, it's canoe paradise, yeah.
I spent October of 2008 until mid-March of 2009 in Saskatchewan up on the this lake called Lake Wapawika. It is so beautiful and so much a place of beautiful sunrises and beautiful sunsets and
wow,
the wonderful clearness of the weather, you know, the day after day after day of sunshine, you know, the... It was cold. It was quite cold there. Get down to 35
sure,
below Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
That was a little shocker for us because our, you know, we thought 25 below was cold.
Well, you get a cool in the Adirondacks, and you have more humidity there. So it's
that's
some
right,
ways it's just as cold there as it is
that's
out
right,
here.
That's right. So I'm thinking that I certainly am going to start spending part of my time. And I want to do it also because I want to help on the tar sands. I just feel
great,
so much like that beautiful, beautiful Saskatchewan, to think that it's being poisoned by the air emissions, and now they're potentially going to start digging up the tar sands over there in Saskatchewan.
They are. Their Quest has got a project going in up in the Lost, just northwest of where you were. You said you're at LaRange.
Yep.
So that's happening. And you know, I'm sure you ran into some people like Harold Cardinal there, the Cree lawyer, who comes from a fishing family. And so... It's not just, global climate change is, of course, crucial for all our citizens, but there's local, regional, and other implications. Like Harold is concerned, as are other native hunters and fishers there, that the huge, wonderful fishery that all existed, we'll say, in Montreal Lake or Wollaston Lake, and I don't know the lake that you're speaking of, but all those huge lakes had wonderful fisheries, and they're waning, and the pH is changing. So the acid
right,
rain fallout is huge there.
Wow.
And the fish are sick. Dr. O'Connor and some of the rest of us organized a press conference just recently about and showing we had a bunch of samples of fish, the whitefish and the conies and the others that they eat traditionally, the native people in Edmonton, the university, and the tumors and the illnesses of those fish. Sadly it'll happen over in those beautiful lakes and rivers, the Churchill system that you would know well as a paddler, that it's happening there. This summer, and you may be aware of this too, we have a large gathering every year. It's called Keepers of the Water, and the fourth one was at Hatchet Lake on Wollaston Lake, which would be north of where you were, but we held it there this year. And they're concerned, they're hundreds of miles. They're at the very extreme east end of our basin. Wollaston Lake flows both ways. It flows west into the Athabasca Lake and on down to the Mackenzie, the Arctic River, Arctic Ocean. And it flows east through the Churchill system. And they're very concerned about the acidification of their lakes and the lichen and all the creatures there. And they're also, of course, they're surrounded by this huge second wave of uranium mining. That was horrific in the 30s and 40s. That's where the uranium came for the bombs that went to Nakashima and Hiroshima, and now they're doing it again. And so, the cancer rates. You talk about cancer rates, Uranium City, and Clough Lake, and those mines were just left. You know, the tailings ponds were just left to ooze and seep into Lake Athabasca. So it's not just tar sands. The basically, and we had a wonderful speaker from His name was Michael Pino. He's a professor at, I think, either Northern Arizona University or someplace in Colorado. But he's a Dene man. He came up to speak at our conference, and he talked about, he's been a uranium warrior all his life, and he knows it firsthand. And he came up, and he basically told us the experience of the American Native people. And basically, I guess eventually the American government somehow they declared that area there in the Southwest sort of as a sacrifice zone, whether they did officially or not, or don't. The problem with our government is they haven't had the courage to basically say they're sacrificing all of northern Saskatchewan, all of northern Alberta, one instance on tar sands, the other uranium mining. And
this is
just ridiculous. So I'm sad to have to tell you that. I'm sure you knew that, Donald. But if you think northern Saskatchewan is going to be some nirvana for you in the long term, it ain't true. It's already.
I understand what you're saying. I had been looking at the uranium problem when I was out there in Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
I was on these websites, and the name, the Wollaston Lake, certainly did come up. Yeah. I remember reading about accidents in mines where radioactive water would be coming into places where people were there and getting poisoned and exposed. I remember reading about this large amount, like you say, of the waste from the mining activities in the past being where it's in contact with living organisms, people, and wildlife up there around Wollaston Lake. Wow. But you know what? The truth of it is, I like what you said there about the Irish warrior. Well,
yeah.
I'm not Irish. My dad is, he's a real mix. He was actually, I think, German. His mother's family was German. But his father's family, I've never really figured out. There's some Swiss, these Hasig, Swiss. But my dad was a veterinarian, and he went to Ohio State after World War II when he got out of World War II in the Navy. And he said that the people there at Ohio State told him that his name was an Egyptian word.
Oh,
so I don't know how far we can go back that way, but it's cool, and I love this warrior stuff. This warrior.
Yeah,
this
we're all part of one species. I think that's the thing you got to remember. We're all part of the one species, and we're in a species that is not endangered population-wise, but we're endangering ourselves and the rest of the whole beautiful planet, as you say, because of our greed and our stupidity. You know, having spent much of my adult life as an environmental educator, and then I look around, I look at my governments, I look at my premier and prime minister and the environment ministers, and from any realistic perspective, they're ecologically illiterate, and because they're blinded by greed, they're blinded by bottom lines, by jobs, and not that they're necessarily all bad people. It's just that our ideology, it's not just capitalism, but whatever bigger is better kind of philosophy leads in that direction. So you're blinded. You're just blinded by, and so they're convinced now that we have to reopen the uranium mines in northern Saskatchewan, and we have to develop these tar sands projects at breakneck speed. The point is, the stuff has been there for 500 or 600 million years, is not going to go bad. It'll be there. We could develop slowly and progressively while we develop wind and solar and geothermal, but they're not going to do that. Somehow they think this stuff is going to go bad, or, you know, a few years ago, remember the guy from Utah developed coal fusion. Of course, there was nothing to it at that point, but their rationale for breakneck development of this stuff is that, well, somebody's going to invent some wonderful alternative energy, which is going to make all this tar sand stuff obsolete, which is a bunch of hooey.
Well, if only that were the case. I hope that is what happens. I hope they're like being a little bum, you know, looking to the future here on this, and it is the way it turns out. But truly, I'm certain the reason they're doing this is just nothing but just pure, unmitigated, out of control, crazy greed. You know, they just feel like, wow, we could be kings. You know, they want it all for them, believe me. Sure, that's
and for their generation, like you say, you know, the Native people talk about seven generations. You always have to plan and do act in the here and now for at least the seven generations down the road. Well, capitalism doesn't work that way, and our governments don't work that way. They're worried about, you know, the next election. And, you know, poor Obama, he's a guy, I have to think he is sincere and headed in the right direction, and Mrs. Clinton and so on. And God, you know, it's, you know, they... they're saddled with this thing, and they haven't been able to do much. They've done some small steps, but I'm entering into dangerous territory because I'm not an American. I shouldn't be making
but
statements.
But I agree with you. The way I see this, Harvey, is that our government, it is corporations. You know, I'm sure
exactly.
Canadians, they probably look at it this way too.
Same up here.
Yep, we've come to conclude here in the U.S. that especially at the federal level of government, all it is the corporations. You know, they rule.
Yeah.
They will let it go back and forth between the Republicans and Democrats just to make the public think there's some kind of contest involved here that they're involved in. But it's not like that at all. It's the
that's what you're, like Jefferson and your other founding fathers, they didn't want that. That's what Jefferson said. He didn't want corporations. Like, up here, corporations have more rights than an individual citizen. The corporations, and they're global corporations now, of course, it's globalized, and it's, anyway, it's... Yeah, we're on the same page there.
Here,
I think.
Our U.S. Supreme Court, our top judicial entity, they gave corporations all the rights of U.S. citizens. And so that means, this is what they wanted, no limits on campaign spending. So now they can buy politicians just left and right without any kind of control whatsoever.
Yeah.
This is sick. You know, it's truly, a lot of the people that I interview, we talk about these people that rule, you know, these people that truly do have the power and decide how it's going to be, you know, unless we stop them somehow.
Yeah.
We think of them as nothing other than sociopaths. You know, they're sick.
Yeah.
You know, they're not functioning to protect the public health or the public good or the seventh generation or the land or the water or anything. They're just crazy with greed. You know, it's horrible.
Well, there's been some good, one of your, I forget the guy's name, he came and spoke here at our progressive conference a few years ago, not Parisi, whatever, is a fellow, you know, looked at the exactly what you're talking about there and came up and shared his book with us. A fellow in Alberta here that if you haven't talked to him or don't know, Andrew Nikiforuk is a wonderful journalist, a critical investigative journalist out of Calgary, and he knows the oil and gas industry. And he's done critical books on oil and gas in several ways, and he's done one on the petrostate. And basically, you know, what you're experiencing and we're experiencing here is, you know, our country is run by oil and gas corporations, and so, you know, the room for any real democracy or for citizen engagement in it is pretty limited. So, yeah, you end up having to work essentially outside the system, attacking the system or critiquing the system, as you're doing so wonderfully with your radio and your programs, and we have to find creative ways to do that, I guess, and that's what we, the little keepers of the water and the keepers of the Athabasca, are trying to do. We're trying to say to ordinary people, native and non-native, it's okay to speak out. You can say what you think, and
that's what we need to do.
Yeah,
that is the
exactly.
key. You have hit upon, I believe, the key to the small people, but in large numbers. See, this is what's always important. I was talking to that Emmanuel Chick Garcia, a Canadian who did the movie The Idiot Cycle, talking to her, and she was making this point that the politicians, even the ones that maybe are appointed government, the government people, the powerful government people, what they are most concerned about are people in the streets that are speaking loudly and strongly, because that is revolution, and they know this because it's unavoidable to be concluded as being that. I truly believe that we need a total global environmental revolution.
I believe
that we need this, and it is about your group speaking out and being right. See, this is the wonderful thing. When you speak out, you're right, and it resonates and it grows. When the greed-driven and the lusting for power, basically, I consider them to be bad people. When these bad people, when they speak, it doesn't resonate with anything other than maybe those of their tribe that do see the world in a very different way than we do, and that are certainly our adversaries. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how people speaking out in growing numbers comes to change the world. And I think it's going to happen faster than we suspect. You know, I just kind of...
I hope so.
Sometimes I think to myself, maybe it's just going to take, you know, a lifetime and future, you know, beyond what I'll see. But I'm really very hopeful that considering all the different elements of this, that maybe it'll happen fast. Maybe this will truly be.
Yeah. Well, I think the social media, and you're part of that. I mean, you're using, I don't fully, because I don't have the speakers set up on my computer and so on. But I think, you know, the approach you're taking kind of it seems like a synthesis of both radio, which all of the oldies still rely on in many ways, and the new social media, which all of our young people and so on use so well. And it's, you know, I think that's, and I hope it continues to be something that the corporations and governments can't control. I mean, that's because you reach so many more people. I mean, this is a global thing. The tar sands, being one of the biggest greenhouse gas producers on the planet, you know, it's a global issue, and that's why we're part of this tar sands group that's some of the biggest groups around the world are involved with that, and we don't always get along, but in this case, you know, we're trying to. So Michael Marks and corporate ethics, and I understand there's some Rockefeller money and so on. There are people that are we're working together on this, and so all of us in our different ways is kind of like an orchestra. You know, you have people have different interests or different instruments and different gifts, and each contribute, as Mark said, each according to their ability, to each according to their need. And I think that's what's happening and it may not happen overnight. I may not see it in my for short in lifetime, but maybe you will, or maybe our kids will, or whatever. You know, I guess that's all you can hope, because you know it's the beautiful little planet is pretty tattered in some ways. I'm glad you got to see northern Saskatchewan in all its glory. That shield country up there is amazing, isn't it? And I'm glad you were there.
I'm going to come back to Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
I feel like this great kind of sense of being drawn, you know, this sense of being drawn to that place because of its natural beauty, because of the goodness of the people that we encountered up there. I was actually doing an information table on reducing exposure to exhaust, you know, not idling vehicles so much.
Yeah.
Right there in the co-op marketplace, there at the one supermarket there in the village of LaRange. And I remember, I'll never forget it, the people came in, and there were so many of them that picked up the information page and asked me if I had a petition,
yeah,
and were just into this social change and environmental,
yeah,
change. And then with this fact that the two issues, those two tremendous issues, this of the nuclear power and the, well, not the nuclear power, but this matter,
yeah,
of extracting the uranium from the earth,
yeah,
and damaging the land and the waters and the people there and the wildlife there. When you put that together with tar sands, it is certainly, I don't know how there could be a bigger environmental battleground on this earth. And I just love the thought of being right in the middle of that. I'm certainly going to start spending a lot of my time up that way.
I'm sure. I'm sorry that we didn't get you up to Keeper's Fort, Wollaston Lake. I mean, had I met you a few months ago, I would have insisted that you find your way out there, because it was wonderful. It's almost a week of, and it's much of the, like, the gathering, the native elders, the chiefs, and ordinary people tell their stories in their own language and with translation, and it's a place where, and LaRange is somewhat that way. You go further north, the more the culture and the languages are intact. But next summer, and here's an invitation to you, put this on your social schedule for next summer,
okay,
towards the end of August, I don't have the day, it's usually about the third weekend, so around the 20th of August in Lac Beauchesne, and that's in northern Manitoba. We keep moving this east. It was in Fort Chippewa, and now then in Wollaston Lake. And next August, Keepers 5 is going to be hosted by the First Nations bands in northern Manitoba. They have all kinds of issues there. They're downwind from all these things we're talking about. Plus, they've suffered huge hydroelectric dam developments over the years that have flooded much of their homeland and caused, you know, we haven't talked at all about these other toxic elements that are liberated, arsenics and mercuries and aluminums and so on, but they're suffering that. And I should say, just as a side note to our larger conversation here about tar sands, much has been made now because of the wonderfully ugly pictures that have been taken of these tailings ponds in the Fort McMurray area, and we know now they're leaking huge amounts, and we now know that the carcinogens that are in those ponds are leaking into the river and the water tables and so on. But so the open pit mining form of tar sands is getting a lot of world publicity and forcing them to, and most recently we had another incident where there were several hundred ducks that went into the one in the snowstorm and died. And that happens continuously, not just ducks, but bears and everything else are dying terrible deaths in those. But what is unknown largely around the world and even in Alberta, because the oil industry and government are doing their very best to keep a lid on it, is, as you probably know, well over 80% of the actual bitumen deposits, they're getting out to make the crude oil, is deeply underground, too deep for open pit mining, and so they're developing experimentally various ways to heat those beds. They're thousands of meters down. They heat those beds, and then somehow or other they have to get that stuff liquefied so they can bring it back up in the recovery pipes, SAGD, steam assisted gravity drainage. Number named for it. But what I'm telling you, I'm sure you know this anyway, because you're on top of this.
I read the Nicky Forok book, and he was pointing to some of these problems.
Yeah, I should give you the name of a fiery woman who, you know, she would bend your ear even longer than I am. Her name is Sally Ulfsten, Norwegian name, Ulfsten, Ulfsten. She lives near Coal Lake, Alberta. And there they've been, Esso or Imperial or Exxon, as you know it, has been developing the deep deposits of heavy oil. It's basically, you know, crude oil in very, very heavy, almost tar-like. And they've been developing ways to, by forcing steam down, to melt it and then bring it back up. And they're using all kinds of surface clean water. They're not supposed to, but they're using fresh waters and so on. But the long and the short of it is that Sally Ulfsten and some other people have gradually been able to show that in the process of forcing huge amounts of high-pressure, high-temperature steam down into these beds and running tubes down to do it, one of the things that they're discovering is that they mobilize these elements, and particularly arsenic. They've demonstrated, and Dr. Noriega from Northern Michigan there has come up to help. He was with the EPA, and he's demonstrated that what happens is this relatively naturally occurring arsenic form, I think it's arsenic 5, it's a species of arsenic, is relatively naturally occurring and relatively non-noxious. But when you heat it at the high temperatures and pressures, you convert it to something called arsenic 3. And that is highly toxic, and it's a carcinogen, and it creates all kinds of problems, and that's only one of the many elements. So, and what we've been trying to do with the Keepers, we've run community meetings around through that region, and much of northern Alberta is underlain by these bitumen tar sands deposits. And so what I'm telling you is that the ugly scenes from Avatar, and Cameron was so wonderful for us, he came up here, but the fact that these tailing ponds are so photogenic in the ugliest possible way, and they get world attention, I'm suggesting that that's just the surface, that much of the real damage is being done is underground, it's unseen, and the government and the industry like it that way. And there's all kinds of potential for movement of the bitumen and other toxics from the beds that they're in to the freshwater beds, to the brine water, one of the biggest aquifers in North America, the Wayu Aquifer. It's as big or bigger than your Glauer Aquifer underlying the Midwest there, underlies that northwestern Saskatchewan and northern Alberta, and they drill right through it. And in the beginning, as they develop concrete, different kinds of high-temperature concrete to seal off the boreholes and so on, and they fail, then you get that infection. We've had a number of implosions at the surface, and I guess I should hold my talk here, except to say that, as you will know from Nicophoric, and we keep helping him with stuff and giving and we're only beginning to know what happens underground. The geological surveys are very incomplete of the aquifers in that part of Canada, and they're not being done because science has been basically corporatized, and there's not enough known about what's happening underground. So again, we get a government and an industry that's racing ahead, developing the underground, the in-situ oil sands, before they really have a handle on the science, on the mapping underground, and the cumulative effects. So stay tuned. I think you'll find that in the long run, as those impacts and the toxic contamination of groundwater and aquifers begins to become apparent, that's where you're going to get some real cancer effects and other other anti-immune problems associated with those
so
things. Anyway, I went off a great length there, but that's...
I'm glad you did that. Just to kind of like fully clarify that particular part of this interview for the listeners, you were describing this steam-assisted gravity deposition technique for obtaining the deep deposits of the bitumen. Just give us, just run through that, just the basic, technology of that, just one more quick time so people can, like, catch this and
okay.
So they focus on it and think about it for the future here.
Okay, well, that particular technology, and I'm no expert on this, and I'll give you, I mentioned Sally Olson, but Wallace King is another oil company guy who's married into the Métis community over there, and he's helped us a lot understand this, but basically, at the surface, they bore one well, through which they forced down tremendous amounts of high pressure, high temperature steam, and that then is infused into the bitumen beds, the tar sands beds, so the formations, and that heat and pressure literally softens and melts the hard tar sands beds. Then they drill a second tube, and these are, they go down and then they go horizontal, both these tubes. And they run a second pipe, a parallel but underneath the steam one. And this has perforations, and this then, when the hardened tar is liberated and formed into a more liquid form, it falls through gravity and is collected in the underlying tube, which collects the liberated, if you will, tar, bitumen, and that is brought to the surface then, and that is the actual producing well that produces the. So that's one form that they use. There's other forms.
And that is done because the deposit is too deep to strip mine.
Too deep. They couldn't possibly mine it.
I see.
Yeah. And the scary things about, they're just developing techniques, and they're doing their best, and they're producing an awful lot of oil already from this underground technique.
How horrible.
Yeah.
And so it's just going to encourage them to do this elsewhere.
Yeah, well, and of course, governments and many Albertans see this as our future, and many, many people make good livings at it. And so it has a momentum of its own. And of course, they're inviting China and Korea, and of course, any number of American projects here and Canadian projects, but even the Norwegians, Statoil, and we've been over there putting a lot of pressure on them, but I think they're going to go ahead with Total is just the big French energy company has got a project, and so everybody's involved with the play, and I guess it takes a lot of work.
This is a huge challenge. You and I get to be part of this huge conflict as to what the future of the world is going to be, whether it's going to be just more and more exploitation or whether it's going to be more and more, of the good vibe and the good intention and the beautiful love of the land and water that has motivated you and motivates many of the First Nations people there in Alberta and all over the rest of Canada and here in the U.S. for that matter. All over the world, the First Nations are great leaders. Let's wrap this up now. I'm hoping that I will be able to attend that conference. So give us a 1 minute quick, where is this conference going to be and the name of it, and just so that people can hear that twice.
Okay, Keepers of the Water 5. This is the fifth in a series of conferences. It's a gathering of the Native peoples living throughout the Mackenzie Arctic Basin watersheds, including the Athabasca. And now we're going over to the east, to northern Manitoba. I think that the site is going to be at Lac Brochet. It's a very small community, and it's on the Churchill system. And so, Donald, you were paddling probably on the Churchill system, and it runs eventually into Hudson's Bay. So it's part of the Atlantic Arctic system as well. So we'll be meeting there for 5 to 7 days late next August. The date and the precise location and certainly the program haven't been determined yet, but it's a gathering we have annually of people who love and want to protect the sacredness of the water. And we'll gather there and we'll hear from elders, we'll hear from scientists, and we put our heads together and strategize as to what we can do to protect the water and to save the remaining pure water we have. And there's a website, it's the Keepers of the Water website, just Google that up and keep posted there. You'll see reports from the previous four, including the wonderful one this year hosted by the Wollaston Lake Dene Band. And it's just Keepers of the Water, and it's not a huge website, and we don't do as much with it as we might, but keep posted as the year progresses. You'll see it into next year. You'll see Keepers of the Water 5 posted. The particulars will be there. It's not an easy place to get to. You could paddle there. People paddled from that place to Wollaston Lake this year. A band of them came, and we welcomed them. So. But there'll be flights in, and I don't know whether there's a access road there or not. This is one of the difficulties, but it's also one of the wonders of those communities. You get in there,
really? And
you're a different world. You're in an intact culture, in this case, Dene or Cree, and it'll be wonderful. So, Donald, you and all of your Echo Warrior friends should come. We'll see you there.
Well, we hope to do that. Thank you so much, Harvey. You've been a wonderful interview. And I'm just going to say goodbye and look forward to the next interview. We're certainly going to have to do an interview to deal with some of these other aspects that you have brought to my attention that we have not covered nearly as fully as I am determined to have them covered. So you and I are going to be talking again, I'm sure. Have a great afternoon, Harvey.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
This is Don Hussig with Loving the Earth, Pollution-Free Revolution. Have a great day.